Okay, paper 10, section 1. Got through the preface there last week. That's on page 108 in the old single column. So I think, yeah, we got off to a pretty good start. I loved that someone had me bring in the author, you know, so that I could bring that out right up front. Just notice how it, well, if you notice all the details, everything is coordinated together to make this the best effort that the revelators can make at having someone author the paper that truly appreciates first the Paradise Trinity. The author's parent is the Paradise Trinity, and who really appreciates the top-down perspective and how that can be communicated to us in very deft ways. And you'll see as we get reading in here, as you might expect, the primary on-ramp to the Trinity is the old notion that if humans have believed in a Trinity, they've had some notion that it's an associate phenomenon that's results from an association of three beings or deities or something. Hence the name. So you'll see that they're certainly speaking a lot to the three persons. But challenge yourself to not just be in the on-ramp mode with what they're saying. You can be saying, okay, they're kind of reminding me of the nature of the three persons, and then I'm going to think about the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the three. You could take it that way. Or you could use it as a nice little reminder of exactly what the three persons are, what they can do, and hence what they can't do. Can you when you really think about precisely what the three can do, can you see what the three can't do? And hence there must be another. Another way to take what they're giving you when they're going through the nature and attributes of the three persons, the three infinite persons of deity. Just that suggestion, to kind of keep that in the back of your mind as we're reading, to see if you're starting to get it a little bit, about. It's like, wait a minute, I know there has to be someone who takes care of this element, and they haven't mentioned that anywhere in talking about the three persons. And instead of saying, well, they must have just not mentioned it, but one of the three must be doing that, it may be that is actually something the three can't do. There has to be another fact that is taking care of that part of the picture. The three can't do as individuals, as any association. They just can't. The three of them do not possess that. And sure, you could say, well, yeah, we're going to call it a superadditive consequence. But like I said, you could just, instead of really thinking of it in that bottom-up mode, and not even really necessarily thinking of it like we were saying where you have it all together and you pull the three persons out and then the Trinity is what couldn't be individuated. You could look at it like that. Or you could just put all four in front of you. Still like that. Put all four in front of you. And just think about them together as four indispensable facts that have to be functioning up there in those upper domains of taking care of of all the details of holding the whole picture together. That's kind of what I was getting at. You know, just, you know, that you know they're all four up there. You know, who has what jobs? All right, so let's just jump into section one here.
One, self-distribution of the first source and center. It would seem that the Father, back in eternity, inaugurated a policy of profound self-distribution. There is inherent in the selfless, loving, and lovable nature of the Universal Father something which causes him to reserve to himself the exercise of only those powers and that authority which he apparently finds it impossible to delegate or to bestow.
Let's just pause 1 second before we go on and just take care of that little detail of the in the title, self-distribution. You know, and you know, right away they, you know, inaugurated a policy of profound self-distribution. Okay, so they're, you know, they're talking temporally. You know, and so if you think temporally, it would seem, you know, that somewhere in the back he inaugurated something. But of course, again, you know, take it out of time, you know, and just put all the facts in front of you here in eternity. And there obviously has to be, like they're saying, one aspect of what's in front of you, if you lay everything out there at the, you know, in eternity or at the infinite level, the absolute level, however you want to begin to think about it, up there at the top of everything, there has to be something that is really fundamentally behind this delegating phenomenon. If there's going to be more than just one, singular God fact, if there's going to be more than one expression of personalized deity, there has to be some element in the picture that doles out the duties, as it were, a distributing function. Okay? And I guess we could go ahead and just bring up the ellipse here. This paragraph, you know, the Father, Universal Father, you know, they're talking about the Father, and they're suggesting there's something in the Father that's tied to this distribution. You know, when we were thinking about these various facets of the Father here in this circuit of the Father, that second circuit out from the center, do you remember what label up there in the functional levels of total deity in the beginning of the forward, what label they attached to this one right here, the universal creator? You know, like this was self-personalized deity. For instance, this was self-willed deity.
Self-distributive
deity. Okay? The universal creator. You know, there is a facet. Just like they're saying. There is inherent in the Father. There's a facet of the Father that's the primary function. It's self-distributive deity. The universal creator. Okay.
So I get that, but it seems like that last sentence could say, causes him to reserve to himself the exercise of only those powers and authority that he apparently has chosen not to delegate or to bestow. And instead of saying impossible, it's hard for me to imagine anything being impossible at that realm.
But that is important. I mean, they very purposely said it that way because that's what they're trying to challenge in us all the time. To recognize, just in this simple sense, it's impossible for the facet of the Father that's called the Universal Father to distribute anything. That facet can't do that. The infinite upholder facet can't do it. The first source and center can't do it. Universal controller can't do it. There's only one facet of the Father that, for which it is possible to function in this mode as self-distributive deity. To allow the universe to have laws, even at the top. You know, there's no historical precedent for that. That's a revelatory challenge in the fifth epical revelation. Can you take all magic out of your thinking about God? All the way up, beyond, go past the ultimate, where you might imagine laws have, you know, ultimate laws as residing. No, go past that. There's co-absolute, there's absolute, there's co-infinite, and there's infinite. Vast domain. It all has to be totally causal, completely ruled by law. There has to be laws of everything. So the moment that you say that there are facets of deity, what you're saying sort of as a subtext is that there are laws about who can do what, how they can relate. These two facets can only relate in certain ways. The law of how it's structured dictates it.
Yeah, but if the Universal Father is the reason that there even is laws, then that means that the Universal Father set up a law that
limited himself. See, that's, he's the only being that can do that.
He chose not to be able to do that.
Yes. And why did he choose to not be able to do that? So that you could exist. That's the thing about those laws up there at the top level. If any of those laws are not in place, you can't exist. There, he will be filling the place in reality that you occupy. He will be butting into your business. I mean, the only way for him to get out of the way is to set up these laws upon himself. He has to self-limit. If he doesn't self-limit, he's unlimited, and there's no place for anything. No place for a star, no place for an ultipodon, no place for Chris Halverson, no, no place for, you know, if he doesn't get out and make it so that he can't get back in, it's so important to appreciate what he's done. You know, he has self-limited. That what he's sacrificed an infinite number of things so that you could exist. He absolutely, trans-absolutely cannot do things anymore because he wanted you to be able to exist.
Yeah. And he exercised his volitional absoluteness. Everything else he let go.
He can't even, for instance, he can't even be an absolute person anymore. He gave up the ability to be an absolute person just so that you could exist. He gave up something that's so beyond what we could imagine, you know, as a possession. And that's just one of an infinite number of things. He gave up, you know, pearls of transcendent price that he gave up so that you could exist.
Yeah.
What he got in return is an infinite number of relationships.
Others.
I would think that it also relates to no greater love than when
right.
a friend
sure.
gives his life. Or
sure.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the whole point. Where does that come from? Again, I mean, there has to be a source for that. There has to be a source of that kind of self-sacrifice. It goes all the way to the top. He sacrificed everything for you. He gave up being God the infinite for you. Okay, yeah, so that's just, you know, want to just bring in the little self-distributive deity, you know, because, you know, if you're starting to get into the total deity, you can see. It's like, oh, I know what they're referring to there. And I can see how they're kind of being very circumspect about it because they can't just sort of jump right in with that. Yeah, but it's there. You know, you can answer the question that they're sort of baiting you there in the way they're writing that sentence. Like, I know the answer to that question. You know, Mr. Universal Censor.
Father is always, that's how he maintains reality. That's how he maintains everything. He's constantly moving. If in an anthropomorphic way to that top of his being, so to speak,
right,
away from the
right,
feet,
right, right. Yeah, and that's what they're alluding to at the end there. There's some things that no one else can do.
Right.
There's only one being who can, you know, be the infinite upholder, who can be at the infinite level upholding. And just that fact, if you think about something that's going to uphold, and it goes all the way to the top level. See, that's another way of thinking about how he pulled himself out. I mean, he made it so that he can't hold anything down here, but no one else can hold, you know, hold the infinite at bay, so that it doesn't fill everything. He holds the infinite at bay, so that there's a place for us to be. Okay, that he can't. He can't delegate that to anyone. No one, you know, can do that job. Only he can do that. But think about how, from our perspective, what a lonely job that is. What a selfless, sacrificial job that is. You know, to take yourself totally out of the game, so that there can be a game.
And it's the Son and the Spirit that can appreciate that the most.
Right. Right. They can appreciate what he's doing. As an infinite fact.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Oh, another thing?
He's totally out of the game when he invests in all of his world creatures.
I just mean in terms of, literally filling the space where we are. He's not filling the space where we are. He's pulled himself out of that. I mean, sure. Don't go beyond what I'm meaning by that. I'm not saying that he's the deist God, where he doesn't have any relationship to reality. He has lots of relationship, but even to be intimate with us, with the thought adjuster, he can't do that. He has to break off a chunk and put it an infinite distance away from him, and then it can be in you. I mean, so a fragment can be intimate, but he can't. He gave up the ability to be personally, intimate, because if he hadn't given that up, it wouldn't be any space for us. Yeah, but again, they're not personal. They're not his personal presence.
They're not personal to us. But
not to him either.
But how?
You know, and it's the reason the encircuiting. They're not encircuited to the personality anchor point, the universal Father. That's one of the things that we've brought up as we've figured out total deity. That fragment that is the adjuster is not a fragment of the first source and center, or the universal thought. It's a fragment of the infinite upholder. It's a fragment of the part of the Father that's lastly, the infinite upholder, the part that's as far away from the personality anchor point as you can get. It has to be. If it isn't an infinite distance away, if he puts it down in, he's down in, and there's no room for anyone again. I mean, he has to free himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. You know, it's the way we often say it, but I'm trying to flip it around. He has to get himself out, not because he wants to free himself. You can think of it that way, but think about it the other way. He has to free the space for you.
His freedom is our freedom.
Right. That's the whole point. If he's personally down in there, he fills everything, and that's a fact called God the Infinite, and there isn't anything else.
So what about the line, in him we move?
Yeah, live and move and have our being. What does the revelation do with that?
So why does he have to get out of the way if we're in him?
No, see, the revelators finally make that clear. They say, okay, now, they start quoting that passage early in the book here. Clear up in the first five papers, they start quoting that. because it's worth quoting. But when you finally get to the Supreme Papers, they say, now remember that quote that we've been holding up even from the Bible? Now, technically, it's not the Father. It's the Supreme in whom you live and move and have your being. See? Yeah. I mean, again, see, it's there as an on-ramp. But when you eventually get to the Supreme Papers, say, okay, now you're mature enough, if you've read all the way to the Supreme Papers, we can give you the facts here. It isn't actually the Father that you're swimming around in. It's the Mother.
Doesn't it say somewhere in the ancient book that the Father knows the name of all the world?
Yeah. He calls the worlds by name, yes. That's because...
Are they referring to the Father?
No, the Father knows, okay, but the Father is all these different facets. The Father isn't just the universal Father. The Father is also the universal controller, which is directly connected to the Isle, and the Isle is connected to every automaton, and the worlds are made out of automatons.
That's a lot of names.
He knows every automaton intimately. As the universal controller, not personally, he doesn't know them. He knows them in a way, see, that really is kind of hard for us to even try to figure out. He knows them as a pattern, you know, an energy pattern, not a spirit pattern. Personality, spirit pattern. He doesn't know them as a spirit pattern thinker. He knows them as a energy pattern thinker, something that, you know, is kind of nonsensical, really, to us. But that's how he knows.
Kind of mathematical.
Well, I mean, he just, yeah, it's not personal, but it is real. It's just as real as personal connection is real. It's not just an actuality connection. It's a reality connection. Yeah. But it's the totally other side of the coin from personality. Okay, let's keep going here.
Universal Father, all along, has divested himself of every part of himself that was bestowable on any other creator. He has delegated to his divine sons and their associated intelligences every power and all authority that could be delegated. He has actually transferred to his sovereign sons, in their respective universes, every prerogative of administrative authority that was transferable. In the affairs of a local universe, he has made each sovereign creator son just as perfect, competent, and authoritative as is the eternal son in the original and central universe. He has given away, actually bestowed, with the dignity and sanctity of personality possession, all of himself and all of his attributes, everything he possibly could divest himself of in every way, in every age, in every place, and to every person, and in every universe, except that of his central indwelling.
Okay, couple things. First, just one little thing. Notice that they tossed in there gently, and then they quickly really stressed the Creator's sons, you know, which we know are God. So it's like, well, okay, well, at least if he's going to delegate stuff, he's given it to right. God, you know, and it's in competent hands. But you notice, you know, bestowable on any other creator or creature. You know, that's a very important point that begins to come out when you start getting into paper 33. You know, it's like, well, okay, now I'm finally to the local universe. Let me read about this whole delegating to the creator son stuff. You know, and you immediately find out that an awful lot of the stuff that you now have to take out of the hands of the Father. You know, historically, we've always thought that the Father was doing that stuff. And we, you know, it's like, okay, I'm gonna allow that to be in someone else's hands. But it's not even in the Creator Son's hands. It's in, say, Gabriel's hands, a creature, or even much lower. A lot of things that we put directly in the Father's hands historically, you know, many passages in the Bible, you know, the Father does such and so. No. Actually, that's a life carrier that does that. A very low creature relative to infinity. Okay? But completely able to do the job. And at this point, this is where you really should stop thinking, okay, I guess I've got to give something down to someone else from where I've had it up with the Father. Turn that whole thought around. The whole point is that most of, as we've tried to, I think that God is this grand and glorious idea. How far are we actually reaching in our flights of imagination to try to imagine how grand God is? Well, we've made it up to a life carrier. That's how limited our perspective is. We think that the most incredible thing that we can imagine God doing is that's what a life carrier can do. Okay? Think about how much greater it is what the Father actually does. What if you actually had a concept in your mind of God the Father that was up there at the infinite level and didn't stop at life carrier level? Okay, or Gabriel level, or Creator Son level, or Ancient of Days level. You know, like if you're thinking God is the great judgment, okay, that's an Ancient of Days. You know, or Master Spirit level, or, you know. What if your concept of the Father was really all the way up there where it belongs? How would that transform your whole sense of yourself and your relationship to the Father? How much less anthropomorphic would God the Father be? Because you can anthropomorphize a life carrier. They're, you know, not unlike us in many ways. They're a creature. Yeah. But the Father, you know, and that's, you see, that's really the point of that, this sort of stuff, of really coming to terms with this whole delegating thing, is to free the Father from the fetters that we've put him in our minds. And the extent to which we have a small God is the extent to which we have problems. If you want to improve the condition on the planet, get a big God concept in people's minds. Seek first the kingdom of heaven. And then all this stuff that you'd love to be able to micromanage and fix because it's not perfect, that stuff will begin to take care of itself naturally. Okay? One of the really big problems is people's puny God notions. Puny, trivial, simplistic God notions. Okay? You know, and it's not because they couldn't have bigger. I mean, all they have is what you have by grace as a child. What a little child can... And they've just arrested their development. They haven't taken delight in cultivating, maturing their notion of God. And so they lower the whole reality to the mind of a three-year-old. And then they wonder why they have problems getting along with anyone. Okay? There's never going to be peace on earth if everyone has some puny God notion in their head. Mm-hmm. True religion with an actual Father. Okay? So that's what this should, when all is said and done, that's what this should do. This should, you know, they're trying to get you to really take it up a notch. Quit putting, you know, trivial tasks in the hand of the Father. All right.
Divine personality is not self-centered. Self-distribution and sharing of personality characterize divine free will selfhood. I want to read that again. Self-distribution and sharing of personality characterize divine free will selfhood. Creatures crave association with other personal creatures. Creators are moved to share divinity with their universe children, and personality of the infinite is disclosed as the universal Father who shares reality of being and equality of self with two coordinate personalities, the eternal Son and the conjoint actor.
Notice a little thing in there for you, besides I'm talking about the details on high. Self-distribution and sharing of personality characterize divine free will selfhood. So that's your challenge. You're trying to move yourself towards God-likeness. What does God-likeness look like? Okay. If there's one shred of self-centeredness in you still, you're not there. Self-distribution and sharing of personality characterized divine free will selfhood. To be godlike is to be like this. To be delegating, giving away everything that you possibly can, keeping only that which you must keep, to be one of those anchor points in the cosmos that God wants you to be. But giving everything else to others. You know, as you're ascending, what do you do as you're the whole time when you're ascending? You're constantly trying to give as much as you can to those that are coming up behind you. Distributing what you've acquired to the limits of your ability to distribute it to others. Holding back nothing for yourself. But not to the point where you become empty. Did the Father empty himself and cease to exist? No. He recognized that there were some things that he had to hold on to. And he did. Yeah. So that's our challenge, to figure out what things we really have to hold on to and what things ourselves, our immature selves, are clamoring to hold on to, but need to be told to let go. You know, don't exalt the clamoring self's desires into, you know, well, that's the kind of thing that the Father would have held on to. So there's a challenge there. But you're moving towards that. Always think about that whole bit of God-likeness. You know, if you're spending a lot of time reading about the nature and attributes of God, you know, that's not some just abstract thing. That's about you. That's what you're trying to strike step with. I want to try to be like that. I want to go beyond brotherly love. I want to go to fatherly love. I want to go to God-likeness. Well, then you need to take on all the nature and attributes of divinity. You know, you can't do deity, but you can take on the nature and attributes of divinity. You know? And you will have done that as a finaliter to the limits of the finite.
We have to start somewhere, developing a noble character.
Right, well, if you think that won't take your whole life, you know, then you don't know what a noble character or self-mastery is. I mean, right. I mean, the very first steps completely will take up your entire life here. I mean, you're not even going to get close to self-mastery in this life. But you can start, and you can keep going. You can always keep making progress if you really recognize just how far you have to go. You know, just don't ever think that this is some sort of a process that's easily accomplishable. So you never let off on the accelerator. You're always going. Every day you wake up and you try to figure out how to take one more step towards godlikeness. Because you recognize you've got an infinite number of steps to go. But you're not trying to do an infinite number of steps. That's overwhelming. You're going to try to do one step. Remember when they say things like, if you could figure out how to just love one other person, right? That would be a huge step if you could just get one, okay? Don't try to love all of mankind tomorrow. Try one. Try to love one person. And hold on to that. And then if you can hold on to that for a couple of years, try adding two. You know, make it two.
How much goodness do we do in total isolation where no one ever sees and no one ever knows?
Yeah, but see, again, that's a great example. It's the incessant clamoring of inescapable self for recognition and honor in this thing. And that self can't do good. Yeah. That self can only be deluded into thinking what it's doing is good. Oh, the person can do good, and the person isn't clamoring for recognition. It's a litmus test. You know, don't go, well, you know, I'm doing great things, but boy, I really wish that, wait a minute, maybe I'm not doing great things, because I wouldn't be wishing for recognition if I really, I'm exalting myself. Maybe I should be a little more humble.
And there's been times where people...
there was a child of self-love. 200,000 years ago who started that little phenomenon. And the more spiritual we've become, the more we can pick up on his idea, and the more we begin to express his ideas. You know? All those sophistries of the Lucifer rebellion begin to express more and more definitively as mankind gets more and more spiritual. Because it's only when you're spiritual that you can really start to do what Lucifer did, think like Lucifer did, and go down the false tracks that Lucifer did. You know, if you're primitive and materialistic, you can't go down the tracks that Lucifer went down. You've got to be spiritual, really spiritual, to be susceptible to sophistry, you know, and to go down those false paths. That takes a spiritually conscious individual. It's not surprising that the more that this, you know, we've got spiritual consciousness awakening, we have this immature expression of it. And that's the unfortunateness of the Lucifer rebellion. Normally, when humans are going through that immature phase where they're starting to wake up, they've got a very positive environment that the epical revelations have established and are holding, you know, so that you don't start using this newfound consciousness and ability in a negative way. But that's what humans are tending to do. Yeah. Okay?
It mentions in the same paragraph we read in the middle there, the personality of the infinite is disclosed.
I was just going to get to that. Yeah. The quick little thing, see what they're alluding to there. Is kind of what I was reminding you of. Well, one way to think about the starting point when there's just a singular fact, instead of calling it the I am, do like they're saying here. Think of, you've got God the infinite, just that one thing. Okay, it's personalized deity. Okay, now imagine taking just the minimal essence of that can be held onto. You know, and letting go of all the rest of it that can be let go of, so there can be something besides God the infinite. But what the Father holds on to is still an essence of God the infinite. And that's why you can still use that term as an expression of a literal fact. If you take the concept of the Father all the way to the limits, if you go beyond the Father absolute to the Father infinite, if you think about the full spectrum of the Father's deity, the Father infinite, and you think of the personalization of that deity, the personalization of the Father infinite, there's only one reasonable thing to call that the personalization of the Father infinite, and that's God the infinite. Okay, but you're meaning the personalization, see, of the part that he, of that original God the infinite that you conceptualize, that he's holding on to still, and he gave away the rest of it. You don't mean the whole thing, but that's the sense. See, there is the essence of the personality of that concept of the singular thing of God the infinite is still held on to by the Father as the Father infinite, not the Father absolute or whatnot, but in the fullness of the Father infinite, going all the way back to the first functional level. Right, yeah. I mean, you know, just going, you know, if you follow the Father's circuit all the way past the first source, all the way back to the first center, so you have you take it all the way to its roots, that full spectrum of deity is the Father infinite. See, and it's right there in touch with the infinite. Yeah.
Instead of infinity.
Right. Okay.
To infinitely limit himself like that, he has to do it consciously. Yeah. He has to be aware of what he's not doing or not.
Right. That's why two of the facets had to be self-willed deity and self-personalized deity, so that he could be right there, fully, yeah, on top of it. Yeah. All those things that are his facets. Think about, you know, you can think about how each of them has to be there. If you take one of them away, he can't constantly be out of the way for other things to exist. All of them are necessary, each one of those components. All right. So that's what they're alluding to there. Him holding on to that little bit of the essence of God the Infinite.
The non-transferable
parts, yep. Yep.
For knowledge concerning the Father's personality and divine attributes, we will always be dependent on the revelations of the Eternal Son. For when the conjoint act of creation was effected, when the third person of deity sprang into personality existence and executed the combined concepts of his divine parents, the Father ceased to exist as the unqualified personality. With the coming into being of the conjoint actor and the materialization of the central core of creation, certain eternal changes took place. God gave himself as an absolute personality to his eternal Son. Thus does the Father bestow the personality of infinity upon his only begotten Son, while they both bestow the conjoint personality of their eternal union upon the infinite Spirit.
Okay, they're going to go on and on and repeat this several times, getting it more and more precisely expressed. They're giving you an initial little kind of tease with it here, hence the two things in quotes. Okay, let me give you this sense of what the qualification is there of putting those in quotes. So we don't mean literally the personalization of infinity by the personality of infinity here, hence the quotes. We'll use it in that literal sense in a little bit. But here, there's a spot in the book we haven't gotten to yet where they talk about the Isle of Paradise. And they describe the Isle as the pattern of infinity. Okay. Or, you know, let's be a little more, you know, the energy pattern of infinity. There is a parallel fact to that, the spirit pattern of infinity. So if you think of infinity and there's some nuclear pattern expression to that, there's two phases of that nuclear pattern expression. There's the energy pattern of infinity, that's what purposes the Isle of Paradise. And then there's the spirit pattern of infinity, or the personality of infinity, quote unquote, that purposes the Eternal Son. Okay, so that's exactly what they're saying. That's in this sense. They're saying the Eternal Son is like the Isle. It's the other side of the parallel nuclear purposing here. Because, you know, one is the absolute of matter and the other is absolute spirit. Okay, so that's what they mean by that there, and hence the quotes. And then, while they both bestow the conjoint personality of their eternal union upon the infinite spirit. Well, now, why did they put that in quotes? Because pretty soon they're going to say it again, and they're not going to put it in quotes. Just like they're going to say personality infinity again, they're not going to put it in quotes. Okay, here, since they're first kind of introducing this, they don't want you to think simplistically about this again. They don't want you to think, okay, I've got the Father's a person, you know, the Universal Father's a person, the Eternal Son is a person, and somehow I'm taking those two personalities and joining them. It's not conjoint personality, literally. Okay, what's actually happening? You have two selves, and there's a super additive self, and it's the conjoint actor, and that self is then personalized. Yeah, so. You know, there's a personalization. You know, don't think of the personality as, you know, directly being a super additive, you know, consequence thing. That's why they're putting it in quotes there. You know, but he's a conjoint self who's personalized, which we're going to call the conjoint personality. Okay, So it's a, you know, and what do we have? We have father-type deity. We have son-type deity. The super additive consequence is the spirit-type deity. And that spirit-type deity is personalized as God the Spirit. You know, so there's that conjoint deity, that conjoint self, the Spirit, that came from the Father and the Son. And then it gets personalized as God the Spirit. Okay, so that's why the quotes are there.
That's the individuality. It's understanding from an individual.
Well, when I say God the Spirit, I'm doing unity viewpoint, but if I say conjoint actor, I'm thinking there's this individual, just like the universal Father is an individual, the eternal Son's an individual, the conjoint actor is an individual. But I could say God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, and do it all from the unity viewpoint too. And that's a little bit more, you know, accurate to think of it that way. That's why I was really saying it. You know, the real super additive consequence is the relationship between the Father type deity and the Son type deity to give the Spirit type deity. You know, and then each of those is personalized deity. So there's God the Father, and there's God the Son, and there's God the Spirit. But thinking about it in the unity viewpoint, you don't think about the God the part first. You think about the deity. You understand the deity. You know, and then you can think about whether or not that's personalizable deity and whether or not that deity is going to be, you know, God the whatever. Like the supreme type deity is personalizable deity. So you can personalize it and make God the supreme. The Paradise Trinity is a facet of deity that's not personalizable. Yeah, so it's not personalizable deity.
It's never God the Trinity.
Right, right. You don't say it that way. Yeah. Yeah. And technically, the designation, the Paradise Trinity, is an individuality viewpoint designation. It's parallel to the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, the Conjoint Actor, the Paradise Trinity. The unity viewpoint is a more complicated thing. That's the whole universal one of infinity stuff. You know, we don't want to get into all that complication. But anyway, yeah. So so that's what's happening there.
For these and other reasons beyond the concept of the finite mind, it is exceedingly difficult for human creatures to comprehend God's infinite Father personality except as it is universally revealed in the eternal Son, and with the Son is universally active in the infinite Spirit. Since the Paradise Sons of God visit the evolutionary worlds and sometimes even there dwell in the likeness of mortal flesh, and since these bestowals make it possible for mortal man actually to know something of the nature and character of divine personality, therefore must the creatures of the planetary spheres look to the bestowals of these Paradise Sons for reliable and trustworthy information regarding the Father, the Son, and the Spirit.
Okay, so, that little reminder that we don't want to ever forget that as we think we're sorting out all of these details, we completely comprehend what we're talking about here. They're reminding us that actually the only thing you can begin to remotely really comprehend is when you downstep it a long ways down, you know, to the local universe level and have something that you can maybe begin to actually appreciate in any true sense. But nonetheless, it's important, even if we can't literally yet distinguish between the type of Father. Now, the expression of Father deity that's in a Creator Son, in contrast to the expression of Father deity that's in God the Father, even though we can't actually consciousize that differential, it's important to begin to conceptualize that different, you know, to know that there is something vastly higher than what we can directly appreciate yet, so that we're always keeping the Father where he belongs at the infinite level, keeping that that potential that we have to identify with the Father that was given to us directed away from anything short of the Father.
Personality. Yeah.
Yeah, to really, you know, especially you've heard me mention this, you know, that the absolute facet, you know, the absolute dimension of your personality is a very dangerous thing if you have a small God concept. You don't want to be pointing that absolute dimension, you know, down at the ground. You know, you need to really, really get it so that it's only aimed at, in, you know, the infinite level. And you don't absolutize things that aren't absolute. You know, you shouldn't, don't even absolutize a greater son, you know, let alone some puny idea that, you know, pops into your little clamoring self's head. I mean, he knows what absolute goodness is, and he's not it. You know, yeah, he's really good, but yeah, he knows what it's like to stand in the presence of the Father, and it's like that's what good feels like. Okay,
let me tell you about good.
So really, constantly catch yourself if you're trying to circumscribe your view. You want to just read some more?
Deity personalization by the technique of trinitization. The Father divests himself of that unqualified spirit personality, which is the Son. But in so doing, he constitutes himself the Father of this very Son, and thereby possesses himself of unlimited capacity to become the divine Father of all subsequently created, eventuated, or other personalized types of intelligent will creatures. As the absolute and unqualified personality, the Father can function only as and with the Son. But as a personal Father, he continues to bestow personality upon the diverse hosts of the differing levels of intelligent will creatures, and he forever maintains personal relations of loving association with this vast family of universe children.
Just well, the way you've heard me express that since we brought up God the Infinite, just kind of notice what they're saying there. I mean, when you're up at that level of God the Infinite, there's no Father. You know, you have to break up God the Infinite. And one way, a simple way of thinking what you do is you can break that into God the Father and God the Mother. Okay, now there's a Father. Okay, and there can be sons and et cetera. You know, you know, when you're looking at it in a normal sort of a way, you know, you know, once you have the eternal Son, then you have the universal Father. But you can think about it in that bigger sense of if you take it all the way up to the infinite level, you've gone above Father and Mother. Now, like if you go all the way up to the infinite upholder, you've gone above Father and Mother. That, you know, the infinite upholder is actually functioning up there above the first source and center. You know, he's, you know, some of this stuff is actually way up there high so that, you know, there can be a personality expression called the first source and center. That has to have room to be too. So when you actually get into the details, you know, you really begin to appreciate just how high some of these facts, like the infinite upholder, have to be. They have to be higher than the first source and center so that the first source and center has a place to be, let alone a place for me to be. Okay, so...
What's meant by the very first, by the technique?
Okay, well, there... I mean, probably the best way to think about that, rather than the bottom up viewpoint, is to think about that as you have, you know, you're visualizing something that's all together, and then you're individuating three persons out of it. And that process is, you know, they're calling trinitization there.
But is that a sounds like a
technical word. It's a technical word. You're going to be a trinitizer once you're a finaliter. You know, we'll be trinitizers because... We'll possess a nature that stems from the Paradise Trinity. We'll have God the Mother nature, and we won't be a creator. We don't have God, that God the Father-like nature, but we'll be a trinitizer. And so, you know, I mean, this is obviously the most the highest, most abstract expression of this. But they're reminding you that what you'll be doing in some much more lowly sense, giving rise to a creature trinitized son, for instance, is if you follow that process up to a source, there's you reach this point where you're imagining that this is all together, and then these three persons are distilled out of it all at the same time, trinitizing. So in some way, obviously I can't explain to you, you'll be doing something parallel to that, something descended from that. When you give rise, when you and another being give rise to a creature trinitized son, somehow you'll be participating in the kind of technical process that stems from this.
We have no real idea what that.
What? Yeah. You just know. You just know. See, what it really is a, it's a type of bringing into existence, a type of originating, that's God the Mother like, not instead of God the Father like. So, this is another way of. See, I mean, like I was saying, if you think of God the Infinite, and then you have God the Father and God the Mother. Another thing that you're doing is you're saying that you're really breaking the originating process into two different facets. One facet that's going to be called creating, and one facet that's going to be called trinitizing. They're coming off of the two sides of the original. The one side is the first center, and the other side is the Paradise Trinity. It gives rise to two type of originating from the original. So they call that thing the original, the universal one of infinity. So just to say it that way is really deep. Like I was saying, I mean, the universal sensor here is really de-emphasizing the first center side of the picture. He's really bringing in the mother side of the picture. You know, and that's fundamentally the way he most intimately views originating. That's how he was originated. He was trinitized into existence by the Paradise Trinity. He wasn't created by one of the three existential persons. He was trinitized into existence by the Paradise Trinity directly.
It's so sparkly.
So it's that you know, at this point, that's all. I mean, all you know is it's another way of originating, and you know that it's not father-like originating; it's mother-like originating. Okay, let's get some more.
After the Father has bestowed upon the personality of His Son the fullness of Himself, and when this act of self-bestowal is complete and perfect, of the infinite power and nature which are thus existent in the Father-Son union, the eternal partners conjointly bestow those qualities and attributes which constitute still another being like themselves. And this conjoint personality, the infinite spirit, completes the existential personalization of deity. The Son is indispensable to the fatherhood of God. The Spirit is indispensable to the fraternity of the second and third persons. Three persons are a minimum social group, but this is least of all the many reasons for believing in the inevitability of the conjoint actor.
Great example. What is, you know, what's between the lines there? Okay, you've got the individuality viewpoint story kind of being told again. He tells it over and over again here. You've taken this, you have this notion that there's this existential blob here, basically, and this completes the existential personalization of deity. You take that existential blob and you personalize it completely. But there's still some that wasn't personalized. That's sort of what's the subtext there. You know, and he could say, that part that didn't personalize, that's what originated me. That's where I came from. I came from that existential deity that is not personalizable.
But he's a person.
Yes, he is. You know, so the Paradise Trinity didn't give him his personality, but his self came from the Paradise Trinity. In the same way that the Father didn't give you yourself. He only gave you your personality. The whole self is a mother creation.
But obviously, personalizable.
Yeah, it's a personalizable self. The mother made a personalizable self, and the Father personalized it.
How do you take something that's non-personalizable and then personalize it?
Oh, as its, you know, origin fact, it's not personalizable. Once it creates a downstep expression, it's personalizable. That's the thing about the Paradise Trinity that they haven't gotten to yet. The Paradise Trinity just isn't just up there. It has the ability to downstep itself. And as soon as it downsteps any, what it gives rise to is personalizable now. It's going to give rise to God the Absolute, God the Ultimate, God the Supreme. Because there's a Trinity of Absoluteness, a Trinity of Ultimacy, and a Trinity of Supremacy.
It gives me another way of thinking. Something that's non-personalizable, my thinking was, well, it's lacking something. Mm-hmm. Which is upside down, because it's not lacking anything. It's above what can be personalized. It has to be brought down to be personalized.
Right. You know? It transcends personalizability. Yeah, there is that which is above. See, that's just like I was saying, you don't want to really think of the infinite upholder as a person. It's a facet of deity. But that's not the person. You know, that's the universal Father. And it's in the same sense. Technically, really, it's above that which is personalizable. So is the infinite capacity. For instance, there's a number of things that are up there above personalizable. And that's why when you say God the Infinite, and then you have God the Father and God the Mother, that God the Infinite is not an actuality. That's a concept. Because technically that is not personalizable. You have to downstep before you get personalizability. Okay.
The first source and center is the infinite Father personality, the unlimited source personality. The eternal Son is the unqualified personality absolute, that divine being who stands throughout all time and eternity as the perfect revelation of the personal nature of God. The infinite Spirit is the conjoint personality, the unique personal consequence of the everlasting Father-Son union. The personality of the first source and center is the personality of infinity minus the absolute personality of the eternal Son. The personality of the third source and center is the superadditive consequence of the union of the liberated Father personality and the absolute Son personality.
Okay, so that's a really great paragraph. To give you another way to think about what we've been talking about. So here we're going to use personality infinity in the direct sense. Okay, in the sense like I was talking about, picture this concept that we're calling God the Infinite. Okay, what we're going to do is another way to think about how we're going to break that apart. So we're going to reach down into the core of it. There's an absolute nucleus of God the Infinite. This concept, God the Infinite. We're going to reach down into its nucleus and we're going to grab that absolute nucleus and we're going to pull it out. That absolute nucleus is God the Son. See, that's the absolute personality. Remember, when you use the word absolute, you're talking about the nucleus of something. Mm-hmm. Okay? There is an absolute nucleus of this concept of God the Infinite. Pull it out. Separate it. So now you have the nucleus, that's God the Son, separate from, so the God the Infinite thing, but with a hole in the center. Like they're saying, take the personality of infinity, God the Infinite, minus the absolute person, minus the nucleus. So if you take that nucleus out, that's a way of beginning to think about what it means to say that he's a type of quote-unquote personality that you have to call father personality. It's a type of personality. See, one, if you take that nucleus out, you take out the nucleating influence. If you take that out, see, as long as that nucleus is in there, there's just the one fact. If you take that absolute nucleus out, this is liberated. This now becomes a reservoir of will that can be doled out. It isn't held absolutely in one giant sphere by that absolute nucleus anymore. It becomes the first source. The father personality. So that's a really great visualization. That's a way of thinking about the difference between father personality and the personality absolute, the father and the son. Just pull the nucleus out of God the Infinite. Break its absolute grip on the ball. Okay, that is God the Infinite. And then you've got the expression that I use all the time. This is the one spot in the book that it occurs. It's the only spot in the book where they literally use the thing that I use endlessly. The superadditive consequence. Okay? So that's another way of thinking about the origin story. In the beginning was God the Infinite, and I pull the nucleus out, and I free the mantle from the core's absolute grip. Okay? Yeah. And now not only can it distribute, but just immediately, I've got two things now, and so I have a super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. Something that you didn't have before. You know, it's super additive. I mean, it's not like I'm going to put the core back in. I'm not just going to add them together again, fill the donut hole. Okay? I absolutely hold them separate. Now there can be something that wasn't there at all. And it's like, well, how do I understand it? Yeah, see, you can't understand it additively. It's not a sim. You've got something that's not part of the original picture. You've got the first super additive consequence. It's not donut, it's not donut hole. Something else. It's the conjoint personality. It's the third source and center. It's God the Spirit. Okay.
The Universal Father, the Eternal Son, and the Infinite Spirit are unique persons. None is a duplicate. Each is original. All are united. The Eternal Son alone experiences the fullness of divine personality relationship, consciousness of both sonship with the Father and paternity to the Spirit, and of divine equality with both Father ancestor and Spirit associate. The Father knows the experience of having a son who is his equal, but the Father knows no ancestral antecedents. The Eternal Son has the experience of sonship, recognition of personality ancestry, and at the same time the Son is conscious of being joint parent to the Infinite Spirit. The Infinite Spirit is conscious of twofold personality ancestry, but is not parental to a coordinate deity personality. With the Spirit, the existential cycle of deity personalization attains completion. The primary personalities of the third source and center are experiential and are seven in number.
Just notice that little line in there. So they finally get down to talking about the third source and center. The Infinite Spirit is conscious of twofold personality ancestry. The first one is like, you know, wait a minute, I have both a father and a mother. Notice how they word that. A twofold personality ancestry, but is not parental to a coordinate deity personality. Yeah. See, so when you think it to that point, see, they're saying, you know, notice that you have something that you could begin to understand as father and mother now. And so you have the first shades of universal father. And Eternal Mother Son. Yeah, but we talked about that. You know, to be really technical, when you're still in this mode where you're giving rise to the third source and center and Avona, it's more universal creator, co-creator pair than it is universal creator, coordinate creator. So it's just the initial shades of father, mother. It's not where you're really functioning in something that's much more directly understandable as father, mother, like giving rise to a creator son, where it's the universal creator and the coordinate creator. There's the father and the mother giving rise to a creator son. Oh, that reminds me. There was, we kind of lost. Where was that? Oh, drat. Where was that previous statement about, it was way back here. The second paragraph of section one, right at the end of the second paragraph of section one. Let me just harken back to that, because I forgot to mention that. About the Father divesting himself in every way, in every age, in every place, and every person, and in every universe except that of his central indwelling. He has a presence there as the Father Absolute. And fundamentally, why is in order to give rise to the sevenfold. We've talked about this before. Remember? In order to give rise to the sevenfold, to creature-identified deity, you know, there has to be literal creatures. Well, there has to be things and beings, both, because there's creators and controllers. You have to have the things and beings that are being directly engaged. And who's at the top of that? The universal father and the universal controller. The father's at the top of that, but down-reaching, down-stepping phenomenon of the sevenfold. So he can't help but... He can't let go of having a direct engagement there in the central universe, because that's how he brings the sevenfold into existence. If he had divested himself of the ability to directly engage Havona, you couldn't have got the sevenfold. So that's what they're alluding to there. Go ahead.
I was just going to say something that supports that is on the forward under 11, the three absolutes. It says, by differentiating his Havona presence from the potentials of infinity. So right. Even there, it's emphasizing right. That.
Yeah,
something about his Havona presence.
Right. I mentioned when we went right. Through the forward there. I alluded. Yeah. There's several spots in the book. You'll see another one coming up here, too. But yeah, so you just appreciate that. That's why they say things like that in the book. I mean, he has to initiate the sevenfold. You know, he's the initiator. That's how he initiates the sevenfold, is by engaging Havona. So he can't divest himself of the ability to engage Havona. So I was just reminded that when you start thinking about this whole bit of bringing the infinite, the infinite spirit into existence. You know, you're simultaneously bringing Havona into existence. And so at the same time that you're getting the God of action, the third source and center, you're getting God, the God of reaction, God the sevenfold. God the Spirit and God the sevenfold come together, you know, in this way of thinking about it. You know, God of action, God of reaction. All right.
I am of origin in the Paradise Trinity. I know the Trinity as unified deity. I also know that the Father, Son, and Spirit exist and act in their definite personal capacities. I positively know that they not only act personally and collectively, but that they also coordinate their performances in various groupings, so that in the end they function in seven different singular and plural capacities. And since these seven associations exhaust the possibilities for such divinity combination, It is inevitable that the realities of the universe shall appear in seven variations of values, meanings, and personality.
Okay, two things. Let's take first note the direct stuff that he's talking about there. You know, like he alluded to at the end of the previous paragraph. You know, he's bringing in the seven-fold individuation of spirit unity. You know, the seven master spirits are the direct expression of that, where you have the seven different combinations of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Okay, so that, I mean, that's the direct thing he's bringing in. And like I said, there you can think of them as the sevenfold individuation of spirit unity. So you're going to have spirit unity in seven phases now. It's not all going to be lumped together in one unity. It's still a unity ministry, but it's not as monolithic as it originally was. But it's this spirit unity. So, seven variations of, the end of this paragraph, seven variations of values, meanings, and personality. Okay, so we're talking about spirit. So values are directly tied to spirit. There's going to be seven variations of meanings, because what are meanings? Meanings are the relationship between things and values. If I have sevenfold values, then I've got sevenfold meanings. I have sevenfold anchors to those values. And personality is spirit pattern. So I've got sevenfold purposing of spirit pattern. So that's why they just mentioned all three of them there. Now, what's the subtext of that? He starts out, I am of origin in the Paradise Trinity. I know the Trinity is unified deity. And then he proceeds to go on and talk about everything else under the sun. Like I said, think about it in the other way. You know, he's reminding you, I know exactly what the Father is like, the Son is like, what the Spirit's like. I know what all the different triunities of association are like. I know what the sevenfold master spirit expression is like. I know all those things very intimately. I know all those things. None of that is the Paradise Trinity. It's not any triunity. It's not any of the seven master spirits or all of them together. It's not, you know, the three persons or any, you know, it's none of that. Paradise Trinity is separate from all of that. That's what gave rise to me. That's my origin. That which is none of those things. So as I was saying, you see, that's a subtext in here. It's talking a lot about the individuality viewpoint, but it's a way of exhausting. You're trying to understand what the Paradise Trinity, and the first way to do it is to figure out what it isn't. Paradise Trinity isn't any of those things. It's something else. And he knows what it is because it's his Father. It's his Father, Mother in one. It's an essence of something. See that, like Gene was just figuring out. That's above Father, Mother. It's above personalizability.
He knows the Trinity as unified deity.
Yeah. The universal one of infinity.
Chris, aren't we to be trinitized beings? But
no, trinitizing.
Oh, trinitizing.
Well, unless you become, say, a mighty messenger, and then you're a trinitized being. Yeah, right. Then you go all the way up. You find the Father. You get inducted into the core of the finality. But before you can take your first step, this fourth fact grabs you. The Paradise Trinity grabs you, trinitizes you, pulls you out of the core of the finality, and makes you say a mighty messenger.
This guy is saying here, I'm of origin in the Paradise Trinity. Is he also saying we also have origin in the Paradise
Trinity? No. No, remember, this is a Trinity origin being. This is a universal sensor. He wasn't trinitized in the sense that a mighty messenger is trinitized. or you will, you know, it's a little bit more in the sense of how you as a Trinitizer could give rise to a creature Trinitized Son. I mean, he was brought into existence by the Trinity directly by a technique of originating called Trinitization. You know, he wasn't created and then subsequently Trinity embraced. He was just Trinitized. Okay. Why don't we just vamp on what we've already experienced here a little bit more?
So we're talking about, this guy's talking about his personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a universal sensor, is that who he is?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what is he exactly?
Like I was kind of kidding around last week, he's the one on high that searches all things. The universal sensor, the universal eye that penetrates and sees all things. He's, like friends, they're the eyes for the Ancients of Days who are going to judge. You know, if they're going to judge, they have to see all things. How do they see? The universal sensors are their eyes, the all-searching eyes of the cosmos. Yeah, oh yeah, they're definitely personalities. But they are very high beings, have very transcendent powers of sight, if you will, of knowing, kind of disclosing, you know, some really transcendent aspects of their origin. We don't need to read. You know, there's quite a bit in there to read. I mean, look in the paper. Where they talk about the divine counselors, universal censors, and perfectors of wisdom, and get a little bit better sense. But some of the most interesting things are not necessarily right there where they introduce them formally, but scattered around through the book. You know, do a search for universal censor, universal censors, and notice some of the things that they're doing and the roles they're playing. An adjuster leaves back to Divinington, but before he can make it out, he's scanned by a universal sensor.
Scanned for what?
Scanned for the record that he possesses. Like if it's your adjuster, the spiritized record of your life, the universal sensor grabs a copy of that. Yeah, not even adjusters are immune from being probed by the all-seeing eye of the universal sensors. Yeah. Yes, you have been scanned. And of course, that's just one being on high that's that's scanning you. There's all kinds of beings that are scanning you in countless ways. But
and I don't think it's going to be in the form of an apology by us saying, "Well, I did this and I did that." It's going to be more scientific.
Just facts, man. Just facts.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just remember, he's a big part of the fact gathering mechanism of the cosmos. The facts have to be known. I mean, how can there be objective management of the universe if all the facts aren't known? All the facts are known.
They're attached to the ancients, isn't
that their primary? They do a lot of things. They function high and low. But all three, of those beings, divine counselors, universal sensors, perfectors of wisdom, do a lot of jobs. Like write papers for blobs of protoplasm like us. This guy took a whole block of time and created this paper for us, So it's not like he's just up there all haughty, searching you out. They come down to the trenches too. But remember what I said. I mean, when he comes down to the trenches, he doesn't come down to the trenches and sort of engage the individuality viewpoint with a lot of intimacy like a divine counselor does. That's why he writes this paper, so that he really brings to the way he writes it that sort of immutable unity viewpoint that he is. And like I said, I mean, someone who has such a perfect unity viewpoint, wouldn't that being work really well to be the eye that sees from above? See? So, we're going to, you see the next one is the three persons of the deity. He's going to get kind of go do this again. He's going to tell the story some more again. But he's trying to find new ways to get you to appreciate how to think about stuff. Like that very unique paragraph that he came up with. It's a really great paragraph in the book. That whole thing of seeing the first source and center and the second source and center in the donut model,
yeah.
is a really kind of clever idea of how...
The personality of infinity
minus.
The center right out.
Pull the donut hole out, and to really spend some time, letting that really sink in. If you do, it's going to help you a lot better to appreciate what the limitations are of the individuality viewpoint, where you just start with the seven donut holes, the seven absolutes of infinity. In other words, you take infinity. And there's seven different ways that you can think of infinity as having this absolute nucleus in it that you've got to pull out in order to liberate the rest of it from its grip. There's a volitional absolute. You've got to pull that out so that you can be a volitional being. Instead of there just being the one volition. You have to pull the volitional absolute out. You have to pull the personality absolute out, et cetera. You have seven absolutes of infinity. So seven absolute nucleating influences that you pull out. Well, obviously, you've got, a very significant collection of seven things there that you can contemplate the consequences of. But what about all this, there's seven different ways of thinking about what's left after you pull out. What about those seven other things? Those aren't any of the seven absolutes of infinity. What do you get when you pull the Isle of Paradise out of center? What's left behind? That's not in the seven absolutes of infinity.
They're really not a thing.
It's unit. Right. It's a little bit crude, but just it's those sorts of thoughts that can really start to get you to see how there must be other ways of looking at this picture that are going to bring in a whole bunch of things that just don't naturally come in when you're just talking about the seven absolutes of infinity and their super additive consequences and stuff. What about all this other stuff? And that's the real unity viewpoint stuff coming in. Things where, from an individuality viewpoint, how much super additivity has to be thought about before you can say, and then you have the cosmos infinite. I mean, that's a lot of bottom-up building. But if you start at the top, you say, well, I have the cosmos infinite. it's just there.
Right.
And I can imagine having a nucleus that's, been pulled out and all this. When you actually, take it from the unity viewpoint, you can think about a number of elements in a very direct way that just, you can't take the seven absolutes infinity, for instance, and somehow say in these two combine together to give the infinite upholder. It just isn't anywhere there to drop out. And all of those things that you just don't immediately follow, really see conceptually, are the donut that's left behind when you pull the hole out of the center in different ways. Yeah. That's the unity viewpoint.
Well, this paragraph talking about the Father being consciousness of experience of having a son and the eternal son having experience of sonship, but if you know that thing that a lot of people have on their desks with steel balls and they hang from a little thing and you pull one back and balls. Bump. Well, imagine three hanging. So here's the Father, and that's the he hits the Son, who has the experience of being, and then the Son is in the middle, and he has the experience of both being the Son and passing the energy on through, and but the last one, the energy comes through and out it goes.
Yeah.
But it starts
with God of action.
And that's the God of action.
Yeah, and great. I love the way, so you're starting to think in analogies. So you can, that's what you're looking for, to be able to get to grok this enough. That you start.